Welcome to the Sober Podcast, part of the Soberverse, created by the team at the Sober Network. The Sober Network is engaged in revolutionizing the treatment industry by creating its own token economy. We offer fresh ideas to an industry that has relied on dated interventions. We are responsive to a new generation of substance users who are attached to their phones, so we can impact massive social change. Our unmatched technology displays solutions of our various brands, demonstrating a thorough understanding of how we get things done. We are proving that technology, along with incentivized human accountability, provides measurable and positive outcomes. Visit us at SoberNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Sober Podcast, part of the Soberverse, brought to you by Sober Network. Today, we have Michelle Weinstadt-Miller, our guest Soberlebrity, for this week's show. She currently serves, she has an amazing bio, and I can't not start this interview without sharing the highlights. She currently serves as general counsel at the Fortune Society, a not-for-profit agency serving those impacted by the criminal justice system, and has published three novels, The 13th Step, Zombie Recovery, and Widows in Law, under the name Michelle W. Miller, and her latest, Gone by Morning, under Michelle Weinstadt-Miller. She's also a wife, the mother of twins, has over 33 years in recovery, and has an amazing sober redemption story. Thank you for joining us on Sober Podcast today, Michelle. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jamie. I want to tell you that when we say gone by morning in New York, it's gone by morning.
Gone by morning.
Gone by morning.
Oh, my God. And I love your accent. I've always have, you know, Michelle and I, listeners, we have known each other for the last several years. She's been sober 1 year longer than I've been in New York City. And I was still drunk more than I was sober in New York City, but I'm starting to, at 13 years, starting to outweigh that time. And anyway, Michelle and I know each other through a New York sober group. And I guess you kind of watched me get sober.
I did. Yeah. I did. And you know, always loved you from day one. You know, and I do, I mean, those landmarks, like when you've been, you know, sober longer than you used or drank and, or, you know, like when you've been sober longer than you've been in, you know, the amount of time that you've been in New York. I've been in New York all my life, so I could never beat that one, but you know, it is amazing. And now I've been sober almost twice as long as I used.
That's
but
great.
I used really hard. So it, you know, it was sort of a, and it wasn't a short time. It was about off and on for 17 years. I started at 13. So.
Wow. It was, wow. Yeah. And I've also seen you go through some serious shit, you know, since I've known you in the meetings and come through it. And we're going to talk about some of that, but you do have, an amazing, sober redemption story. You were formerly incarcerated person who returned to the practice of law following disbarment due to drug-related felony conviction. Could you share some of the highlights and lowlights of that story, of that path? Okay.
Well, like, as I said, I was an addict at 13. Once my father got got diagnosed with primary progressive multiple sclerosis when I was 13, had been got really handicapped really quickly. And I very quickly became handicapped myself by drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can just say briefly, my first bottom was that I was raped at knife point within a few weeks of starting to use. And then unfortunately, I didn't associate that with the fact that I was, you know, put myself in a position to be vulnerable. Right. But and I failed half my classes in my first year of high school. And then I, you know, was sort of got to a place where I was able to hide my addiction or tone down my addiction and started trying to live my life based on ego. So I started building up, you know, I was completely humiliated and traumatized in that first year of my addiction and managed to tamp it down, got a black belt in karate, graduated high school by 16, graduated college by 19, graduated law school by 22. So, and all during that time, so I had a lot of athletic achievements. And, but during that time,
you were a high achieving, functioning addict.
Yeah. And we're the tough cases, you know.
Right.
Well, and I wasn't really a functioning addict because meanwhile, by 17, I had moved in with a drug dealer. And even though I was a 4.0 student and I was sort of like the trophy, the drug dealer trophy wife, you know, the girl. You know,
I love that. Yes. Yeah.
He was 43 and uh-huh. I was 17. Uh-huh. I mean, so that, you know, and so I am, you know, getting 4.0 in college and doing all the and burying myself in my work. And he was parading me around. But, you know, I did hit several, you know, got cocaine during that time. It affected my grades in law school. I was sort of headed to law review with really good grades. And then I decided to do more cocaine to study more,
sure.
Like that old commercial.
Right.
And that did not work out very well for me. And it did, you know, impact my career and for life and caused me a great deal of regret. And, you know, we when you come in, you work a program, you stop regretting the past so much, but it, you know, that regret will eat you up until you figure out what, you know, how it can do some good for yourself and others that you've mm-hmm. lived through that. But I, you know, I stopped using. And I started using again, like I was 22 at a big firm in New York, Park Avenue firm, and everybody was doing cocaine and one of the senior associates, and I'm like 22. So I'm young. I'm really uh-huh. young. And a senior associate says, hey kid, you do coke? And the next thing I know, I'm off to the races again doing coke because I was like a Titanic seat shifter. I would just switch seats on the Titanic because I didn't understand the nature of the, you know, of addiction that
right,
you can't just
right.
do use one, you know, substance and not another substance that the same thing kept repeating the same mistakes because I just didn't know. It wasn't a moral deficiency. It was like actually just ignorance about mm-hmm. what the nature of this whole thing is. I'm not a person who's going to be doing moderation. I know there's people out there advocating moderation. That is not my story. Is moderation is like a really bad deal for me. But I ended up like going to the firm, and within a year and a half when my dad died, I was really upset about that. And so of course I headed further into the cocaine. And within, you know, about a year and a half at the firm, I decided that to sell drugs to, you know, so I didn't have to pay for my drugs. And
right, sure.
I ended up being very good at selling drugs. You know, mm-hmm. I'm a high achiever. I became within minutes, I'm selling kilos, you know, like I mean, it was just an insanity. And I could not stop doing coke. So it was 4 or 5 days, perforated my septum, you know, and I couldn't really work. I mean, so I quit being a lawyer and started being a drug dealer and thought that was a sort of a rational kind of a career path because, you know, the cocaine had addled my thinking.
Sure.
And then, you know, in the end, though, I switched seats again and decided to do pure heroin and, you know, ended up facing 15 to life in prison for a case that I fought for 4 years mm-hmm. For, you know, A1 felony level drugs under the Rockefeller law.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I did some time on Rikers Island waiting for trial. Then I got bailed out. Then I got busted again. Then I ended up on Rikers for a few months, and I ended up fighting this case for a long time. And I won the big case law, you know, had to plea bargain. I thought I was kind of high when I plea bargained. I think, you know, back, it took me a while to figure out that I probably shouldn't have, but whatever I did. And I was disbarred for like, you know, 7 years because of a felony conviction. And, you know, I was in no shape to practice law anyway. I wasn't even in shape to work in McDonald's. and plus, I was overqualified for McDonald's, so they wouldn't hire me.
But, of course.
Yeah. And wise as they would be. And so I ended up being but I did end up getting clean and sober in 1989. Mm-hmm. And haven't felt the need to drink or drug since. And then my life started coming together, you know. Yeah. And I, yeah.
How did you turn that disbarment though into a? I'd love to hear about that. When you got your law license back, or
well, I mean, it was a recession when I got my law license, or a mini one, not as bad as some of the ones we've had since. But I couldn't get a job to save my life. Nobody was hiring me. And then I was on a drug prevention panel, and I, you know, and I met somebody who was in the, you know, a prosecutor with the city, a head of a prosecution division of the city, and for juveniles, and he knew somebody, and they knew somebody. So that's really, you know, if otherwise nobody was going to give me a chance. It is really difficult to get a job with a felony conviction. And now there are laws protecting people and there are all sorts of things. But back then it wasn't, there were none. And frankly, I have been practicing law for over 25 years now, very successfully. And up until this newest law passed, which is called the Fair Chance Act in New York, and it's not applied, it doesn't, they don't have it everywhere, but in New York, they can't ask you about your felony convictions and can't consider it until they give you an offer. But up until a couple of years ago, applying for general counsel positions and deputy commissioner positions and with the city, you know, I would be telling my, you know, story of my drug use when I was in my 20s at an interview, you know, and then you're always having to figure out, do I raise this now? Do I raise this later? You know, like you have to add that to your skill level in interviews. How do you talk about your felony conviction? So I'm glad that that does not have to happen anymore.
Wow. Amazing story. And I'm glad that doesn't have to, it has to happen either. I wish it were countrywide. So you have over 33 years in recovery, and how have you maintained continuous sobriety?
Well, I make meetings regularly. You know, I've never stopped making meetings. Thankfully, I'm a meeting maker. I'm getting a little bit weary of Zoom and haven't quite transitioned back to live meetings. And so
I haven't either, other than I spend time out in the beach in Fire Island, and there I go to meetings, and it's very easy. It's like 5 minute walk, and every day at the 6 o'clock.
I could see that.
But back in the city, I haven't transitioned back to in person meetings by and large.
And I think some people won't ever. You know, I've heard from some people that they don't see any need to ever do that. So we have a whole new tool for people who don't want to walk and, you know, into a room with, like, we used to talk about that at Citigroup, like the fear when you go down the orange staircase and downstairs and you have to face all these people sitting there who would look at you. And so now, you know, people can come in and just turn on a Zoom meeting and keep themselves anonymous for a little bit. You know, I don't know, I guess. Right. Or I guess in retrospect, we'll find out one day whether that was a benefit or a plus or a minus. But, you know, I have found that it is impossible to say when you only have a couple of years sober, what you're going to go through in the future. And I've gone through a bunch of things, you know, and, you know, being grounded in meetings meant that no matter what I was going through, and I include whatever emotional stuff, because, you know, you think about you're going to go through some events in your life, but actually, you know, it's the internal stuff that can really like jive you out of your mind and drive a person to drink. Right.
You're right. You're right. That's a very good point.
I've always been grounded in meetings.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, there's a question I always ask our guests. It's usually the last question, but I think this is a good time to ask it because you're already headed there, or you're already touching on that, which is, what is the most difficult thing you've gone through in sobriety, and how did you get through it?
Right. Well, there are some things that I won't discuss because they might, you know, impinge on somebody else's privacy. Sure. I've certainly been through, you know, the trials and tribulations of people who are in relationships with other people, like in the world, you know, whether it's your spouse, your parent, your kids, like we all are going to go through something with, you know, having to deal with other people and accept other people where they are and figure out where we're going to be in our lives. So I've been through a bunch of things, like the normal stuff, your mom dying, you know, my mom mm-hmm. dying and the various things like that. I would say, though, that the thing that might have been most dangerous to my recovery was that I was working in a kind of hostile workplace, you know, at about mm-hmm. 25 years sober. And it was very hard on my self-esteem being, you know, it wasn't the right job for me. I mean, which can happen to anybody. You land in a job that's really not the right job for you and doesn't emphasize your skill set. Like the things you're good at is not the things they value, and the things you're bad at are the things they value. And it, like you want to get out of there, but the anxiety of being criticized a lot, you know, makes it very hard, and you end up sort of boxed into a corner. And what I would say is that what I had is a lunch hour meeting. And mm-hmm. I went every, and it wasn't the one that I know you from, but it was, you know, every day I would go and I would help some person who was trying to get sober. You know, I would help somebody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you go out at lunch and you remember who you are, you know, at your core, that you're a valuable person, that, you know, I like to say our experience, strength, and hope is our superpower. Mm-hmm. You know, like you've got superpowers, because people walking out on the street, they don't know, they can't say a word or two to somebody and save their life. We will experience, if we're in meetings and if we're interacting with people trying to get sober, we experience time and again what it is to save a life just with our own experience, you know. And people will come back years later and tell you, you know, when you told me so and so, that was the turning point for me. And those are like the experiences that make it way easier to get through other challenging things. So, you know, hang on. Perseverance is a principle of the program. Sometimes you have to practice it, you right. know?
Sometimes, yeah, exactly.
Yes. And that's what I did. I kept showing up, kept doing everything I was taught to do, talked about it, made meetings, wrote about it, meditated. I prayed for my boss, which made her much better, I want to say, you know. And every morning I would walk in and I would come in and I would say, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Like as I would walk down the hallway and I'd say good morning to her and she wouldn't say good morning, mm-hmm. you know, and I would just say good morning to her. And every morning anyway. It was like, okay, so who was suffering in that situation? I said good morning and I'm feeling good, you know. Exactly. I knew this guy in recovery who used to say kill them with kindness. I mean, like, he was like, he has far more time than me, and he would, you know, doing good is the best revenge. Like, to take the high road, feel good about yourself, and people don't have the ability to hurt you, even if, you know, hurt people, and they can try, but they don't necessarily have the ability to hurt you the way they might.
Beautifully said. And that's a good place for us to take a quick commercial break, but we will be right back with Michelle Weinstadt-Miller. So stay with us.
The Sober Podcast is giving a voice to recovery and is now part of the Soberverse. Join our new virtual sober environment where you can connect with other people like yourself or find helpful resources on the following digital spaces: Soberverse.com, SoberNetwork.com, Sober.com, SoberSystems.com, SoberPodcast.com, SoberCoin.com, and RecoveryCoaches.com.
And we are back with Michelle Weinstadt-Miller. You have written three novels, and I'm going to say the titles again: The 13th Step, Zombie Recovery, Widows in Law, and your latest, which is Gone by Morning.
Exactly. You do that so well, Jamie.
Did you write or want to be a writer before you were sober?
You know, I did in college. I know I was considering, because I had always said I was going to do to be a lawyer because, again, I was doing this ego thing. Like, I felt like people would be impressed and I would show everybody in the old neighborhood that thought I was a loser by becoming a lawyer. And then I stuck to that, you know, and which was unfortunate because it took me until I got to the Fortune Society 2 years ago to actually enjoy practicing law. I've never really liked it that much. I'm sorry, my cat is Zoom bombing me. Stop.
Yeah, it's okay.
And my dog is eating a safety razor over there on the back there. It's, this is a zoo. I'm in a zoo. This looks peaceful, but it's really not. So what were we saying? In college, I started thinking, wow, I thought maybe I'd want to be a journalist. Mm-hmm. And I thought of, you know, transferring over to, you know, Columbia Journalism School. My mother told me, no. There's no, that's a very insecure, very competitive, you know, my mom was an old union kind of like a Jewish union lady, like, you know, like you've got to be safe. You've got to
be
a safe
security.
Job.
Financial
afterwards,
security.
I thought to myself, gosh, I'm number one in my college. I graduated number one. Is it competitive the problem? Like, really?
Yeah.
And so I didn't do it because my mother said, no, you can't do that. And so I just let it go, you know. And I don't remember when I started thinking about writing a novel. I think that I'm one of those people who always thought about writing a novel, but I don't really remember when that was. But I do remember it really bubbling up for me in early recovery. And so I wrote my first one in about 1994, I think. So I'm dating myself. And it, you know, I got a really, you know, prominent agent for it. And they told me it was going to go to auction. And then, and that I was going to be like famous.
Right.
And it didn't sell. And so then he dropped me like a hot rock.
Yeah.
I got another, I mean, I did that, you know, I mean, for anybody who's writing, you know, I can say that I was not a person who was an overnight success. You know, I wrote, like, I stopped writing when my kids were little, you know, because nothing had sold. I had gotten, had a couple of agents, very good agents, and things weren't selling, you know, and it wasn't until the last, I guess, 5 or 6 years that things started really selling.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
So.
And you work within the criminal justice field. Are there events in that, from real life that you make that make it into your books?
Well, you know, I'm not a criminal lawyer. So, I mean, I Widows in Law takes place in and around like City Hall and like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, City Hall politics there. So I've been, you know, I was in charge of ethics for New York City, ethics prosecution. I prosecute. Prosecuted politicians and
nice.
Public servants, during the de Blasio administration. So, you know, there was a lot of business during that administration. So a lot of that comes in. One of the things that I find comes in, and yes, I there seems always to be a courtroom scene somewhere in my books. And there also seems to always be an incarceration scene of some sort. And one of the things that I've realized in retrospect is that I was so traumatized by incarceration that the catharsis, like I always need to talk about it. So no, it's the lawyer thing is, you know, it's great because I actually understand the legal end of it. So I could do it from that end and I could do it from the incarcerated person end. And so it's unusual amount of experiences from both ends of the legal justice system that do end up in my books.
And how does recovery affect or influence your writing? Does it show up in your books? I mean, of course, I know your first novel, it certainly did.
Yeah, and that was sort of a satirical critique of certain very dogmatic groups of AA. So it was an insider's.
And we're talking about the 13 step zombie recovery.
Yeah. It's the insider's love letter to AA that, you know, that even lovingly like makes fun of certain groups that are very, very dogmatic. I'm not a very dogmatic person. The most times there's at least somebody in recovery in my books. Guess I understand people in recovery the best. And I think one of the themes that have been in at least a couple of the books is the idea of, and which is sort of my horror, is the idea of being sort of pulled backwards into the old life. Like the old life was so horrendous and so dangerous. Like it was just one big death-defying stunt. I mean, being like a girl dealer and you know, 1980s, you know, cocaine and crack world, like dealing with the Colombians and the cartels and stuff like that one-on-one was a little crazy. And so I've got a great deal of PTSD from all of that stuff, you know? And so like, and it just seems like in at least a couple of my books, it's been about people being like threatened by their old lives or pulled backwards into their old lives and fighting to have this new life. And, you know, so there's, you know, and that's
also a great, you know, a lot of old film noir movies. Mm-hmm. There's that dynamic. It's not about being pulled back into drugs and alcohol so much as it is being, it's, you know, it's like the guy that sprung from prison and is trying to lead a good life, but the old guys are, you know, wanting to pull off one more heist.
Exactly.
Or need him to,
and that's what these are about too. They're not really about wanting to use. None of them are about a person struggling that I can remember. They're not about, except in the zombie book, there were some people who had trouble staying clean in the zombie apocalypse. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a kind of life on life terms in the zombie apocalypse can be a little bit trying. But other than that, everybody, you know, in the books are pretty solidly in recovery and just trying not to get killed, you know, by like, you know, due to their old lives or associations and the like, or bad choices.
And you lived that, right? just trying to stay alive in that old life.
Yeah, it's a miracle I'm alive. You know, I don't think I would have lived through it nowadays, not with the kind of, you know, fentanyl and all that out there. I'm sure I would never have made it.
And it's a miracle we're all alive. It's a miracle. My story is very different than yours, but there were a lot of death defying stunts in my story as well. I remember after my father read my recovery memoir, and he just blurted it out like a couple of days later. He goes, "My God, it's a wonder you're not dead. All those people you went home with." My Texas father.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Goodboy, we are the 80s. Mr. Goodboy loomed large, right? As well. Yeah.
Because I did wake up with some crazy people,
some,
you know.
Various characters. Yeah. I definitely, one of the things in one of my books is a guy named Tommy Karate. I think he's still alive. I think he's doing life in prison, but there was a serial killer that I used to like hang around with. And I was like, well, I knew he was a hitman, but I didn't know he was a serial killer, you know? I'm not sure that there's like that big a difference between the two.
Wow.
But he was considered like, you know, after the fact when I realized, and because I read a true crime story when I was already like 15 years clean and I realized what he was doing, that mm-hmm. he was murdering female drug dealers. And I used to be, you know, I was his connection and we used to hang out. And I guess he was probably setting me up. But I guess he liked me because we were both martial artists and I, which is why he was called Tommy Karate. Yeah. You're not supposed to talk about mobsters, but since I'm not a mobster, nobody will hit me for talking about a mobster.
And
he
And I think the only mobsters listening are mobsters in recovery. And so there's probably a code.
Okay. So forgive me.
I think we're fine. Well, I think you're fine. Listen, this has been one of the most fascinating and entertaining sober podcast interviews I've done. So thank you for joining us. And how can our listeners first of all, how can they get your books and how can they get in touch with you?
Wow, thank you. MichelleWMiller.com is the
website.
Is my website address, MichelleWMiller.com. And you can find, Google Michelle Weinstadt or Michelle W. Miller, and you will find me on Twitter
And the books are all on Amazon
and everything. The books are everywhere. You can get them everywhere, including in the library.
Oh, good.
It was the last one was a Library Journal selection for Outstanding.
Bravo.
August 2021 or whatever, you know, and so the libraries have it and you can definitely get my books on Amazon. Michelle Weinstadt Miller or Michelle W. Miller. I have two different names, so sometimes it's hard to find one if you look at the other, but I'm there. And I'd love to hear from anybody on social media. I'm usually on very active on Twitter, so just look for me on Twitter and I will be very happy to chat with you.
Well, fabulous. Thank you for joining us on Sober Podcast today. I am Jamie Brickhouse, your host. I tell true stories every day on TikTok wearing high heels. You can follow me, Jamie_Brickhouse. I'm a writer and performer, wrote a book called Dangerous When Wet, a memoir of Lose Sex and My Mother. You can also find that on Amazon. And you can find out what's going on with me on my website, jamiebrickhouse.com. Michelle, thank you for joining us.
It's been
so fabulous having you on and catching up with you. And I am signing out from the Sober Podcast. Jamie Brickhouse, your host, will be back next week with another show. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Sober Podcast. We hope that you have found this episode helpful and look forward to you joining us next time. As we continue to grow and implement positive change, we hope that you'll share our podcast with your friends and loved ones. They can find us on all the major podcast directories. If you have an idea for the show, want to leave positive feedback, ideas, or comments, connect with us on thesoberpodcast.com. You can also reach us on our social media platform on The Soberverse. We'd love to hear from you. A special thanks to all those who make this show happen. Jamie Brickhouse, our host, Carrie, our producer, Carl Fessenden, our voice, and our sponsor, The Sober Network.